thank Ms. Johnson as well. So our last case for argument, Boyd versus Barnhart, Ms. Goldblum.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel, I'm Marcy Goldblum on behalf of Plaintiff Boyd in this matter. In this case, in finding that the government's position was substantially justified, the district court did abuse its discretion. When it remanded this case, the district court's decision states unequivocally that the ALJ failed to comply with Social Security Ruling 96-7P, but the court didn't just stop there. The court enumerated that, and it was more than just simple articulation. The court said, from my review of the record, I conclude that the ALJ's decision must be reversed because the ALJ failed to follow Social Security Ruling 96-7P in his assessment of Boyd's credibility.
So how do you reconcile the fact that the district court's later order on the fee petition characterizes the court's own opinion differently? I mean, don't we owe some deference to that? And when the district court said didn't follow 96-7P, maybe he meant there wasn't enough articulation?
Judge, I think when I first read the judge's EJIA decision, what struck me was how short it was. And my sense was that the court did not apply a correct EJIA standard. And I think part of it may have been that the court, I think the government tends to argue in a lot of cases that if it's just a lack of articulation, they cite to the Stein case and say EJIA fees aren't available if there's just a lack of articulation. Well, first of all, in this court's recent Conrad case, made clear that Stein does not stand for the proposition that EJIA fees are precluded if it's just a lack of articulation. Second of all, in Stein, the linchpin of that decision was that the degree of articulation, the level of articulation required by Social Security's ALJs was imprecise. Then Social Security Ruling 96-7P was promulgated. It took out the imprecision. And in this case, I think the district court judge really didn't do a thorough investigation on the EJIA level, because when he remanded the case, he didn't just remand because of a lack of articulation with regard to Social Security Ruling 96-7P. He also says, he does identify that there's a lack of articulation, but then he goes on to say there are other problems with the ALJ's assessment of Boyd's credibility. In finding that the claimant's treatment ended in 1999, the ALJ was factually incorrect. In finding otherwise, the ALJ erred in his assessment of the record.
Where are you reading from?
That's the decision on the merits,
page
13, and it's page 15 of the plaintiff's appendix in the brief.
Page 15?
Of the plaintiff's appendix,
okay.
Yes. The court said that in finding otherwise, the ALJ erred in his assessment of the record and failed to consider a line of evidence that Social Security Ruling 96-7P states must be considered in assessing a claimant's credibility. So here, it's not just that there's a failure to articulate. He misstates the record and failed to consider a line of evidence that the ruling says he must consider. Now, in Hallmark Construction, the court set out that in order to find if, when looking at an EJIA case, in reviewing petitions, it requires to show, in order to avoid paying an EJIA fee, the government has to show that its position was grounded in, number one, a reasonable basis in truth for the facts alleged. Well, here, just to begin with, the judge was wrong when he said there wasn't any evidence after 1999, and the district court judge remanding the case says that the judge failed to consider a line of evidence. So you have that to begin with.
Does it make any difference? I thought the government said that this post 1999 treatment was something that had not been particularly called to the ALJ's attention. He had just
I don't think that matters. First of all, even this court has said that even when an individual is represented, the ALJ has a duty to fully and fairly develop the record. Well, here the records are in there, and it's there are records significantly after 1999, and for the ALJ to say as part of his credibility determination, well, look, this guy didn't get any treatment after 1999, that, as the court characterized it, this is the remand in court, he failed to consider a line of evidence. You can't not follow the ruling. You can't fail to consider a line of evidence and still be substantially justified. When Congress enacted EJIA, the purpose was to attract attorneys to represent these most needy clients. And, in fact, this was a case from the state of Wisconsin, and I can tell you anecdotally, there's not a whole lot of plaintiff's counsel who will take these cases in the district courts.
I don't think the issue is whether a particular ruling is substantially justified. I think the issue is, was the government entitled to defend this ALJ decision?
Actually, Your Honor, no. I have to disagree with you because it's a two-pronged basis. In order to be substantially justified, it's not just...
But look, you can't reverse a... Ordinarily, you can't reverse an ALJ without a finding that his decision wasn't supported by substantial evidence. But you wouldn't say that, therefore, you know, couldn't be substantially justified if it wasn't supported by substantial evidence, could you?
Well, no, that's true. However,
There have to be error for reversal. So substantial justification can't be equated with freedom from error.
No, it's not.
There has to be something egregious, doesn't there?
Well, no, I think it has. It's a far less standard than just merely egregious. Although it's a district court case, in the case of Henderson versus Barnhart, the court noted that an ALJ commits a reversible error if he or she fails to abide by the rulings of the Social Security Administration, citing to Prince versus Sullivan. And the district courts in the circuit have consistently awarded fees under the EJIA under such circumstances. And Judge Conlin explained in that where an ALJ does not comply with the clear requirements of a Social Security ruling and the commissioner opposes reversal and remand, the commissioner's position is not substantially justified. Now, that's fully consistent with congressional intent in these cases, because the intent
so
is...
What's the case where the ALJ is reversed, but the government is deemed substantially justified?
Well, for instance...
That would be a good example.
I don't think many of them are good examples, actually, but, for instance, the government does cite to Stein...
Well, I wouldn't worry about cases. Give me an example. An example? Reversible error, ALJ's decision thrown out, but nevertheless, there was substantial justification.
Okay. In a case where an administrative law judge, for instance, in weighing evidence, although it's clear that the judge reviewed everything in the file, perhaps didn't explain his reasons quite well enough for accepting one report over another, although it's clear, so that the court remands it so that there can be a greater explanation.
Is that what you're saying, just failures of explanation?
No.
That's the only thing that can be substantially defended from a fee award?
Quite frankly, Your Honor, I don't think that
that's why I think the real standard is, or ought to be, was there enough, even though the ALJ's decision was dubious and so on, was there enough to warrant defending it?
You're giving that as one example, but maybe this is all going to wind up in the end in that same place. there can be errors of evaluation of the evidence if the law
is followed.
Maybe even the interpretation of a ruling is fairly debatable, then surely you're not going to say the government is entitled. The government can take one of those positions.
I think
strikes me there could be a number of instances which may, in the end, boil down to the standard Judge Posner's talking about. You know, is there something there the government legitimately can defend?
I think, for instance, if there's a standard that's a bit amorphous. And the reason why I think looking back on Stein and the genesis of cases since then is interesting is that the court noted that the level of what is requiring from the judges at that point was very imprecise. So then you have this ruling, the Social Security ruling 96-7P, and says this is exactly what we must have. And then the court remands and says, you didn't follow this.
So if the ALJ simply doesn't touch some of the bases that 96-7P says, you know, we have this list of seven things and you only talked about five of them, you would say that's not substantially justified?
You know, I don't think that there's necessarily a hard and fast rule. I think if there's necessarily substantial compliance, then perhaps the government can avoid a fee. But I think when you read the decision of the district court, there was no substantial compliance in this case, and that in remanding the case on the merits, the district court judge identified several reasons why the ruling, which is well established, was not followed. In this case, the government's position prior to litigation was not substantially justified, and it was an abuse of discretion for the district court to so find.
Okay. Thank you, Goldblum. Ms. Wangrim?
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Jesse Wangrim, arguing today on behalf of the Commissioner of Social Security. Mr. Boyd is arguing today that you need to find an abuse of discretion here in the district court's EJIA decision, when in fact the district court made clear in its EJIA decision that this was a close case.
But the thing that's interesting, actually, is the same thing I mentioned in Ms. Goldblum. If you look at the district court's merits decision, there are points that SSR 96-7P specifies must be considered that the ALJ failed to consider. So, for example, toward the bottom of at appendix page 15, opinion page 13, the ALJ also failed to consider the medications Boyd was taking for pain in assessing his credibility as SSR 96-7P instructs. Now, if we're going to start saying the commissioner is entitled to defend ALJ decisions when mandatory elements are ignored by the ALJ, that would be a very forgiving standard, it seems to me. There are, you know, inaccuracies, and you have the impression, looking at the second opinion, that the district judge was just kind of tired of this case and said, well, you know, in the end it was a close case, no fees. But he's not operating in a vacuum on the fee decision here.
Well, certainly not. I would disagree with the characterization that there was no consideration of the pain medications.
Well, but that's what the district court judge said in his first opinion.
Well, he's saying that some of the medications weren't considered. I'd like to clarify that. He's saying that not all of them were considered, but some of them were considered.
Well, we can both sit here and read this paragraph. Mm-hmm. I read this paragraph as criticizing the ALJ for failing to consider the medications. Then he rehearses what the record shows and these various things. And he goes on to say, again, the record doesn't disclose how frequently Boyd found it necessary to take these medications, side effects, and all that stuff. So he is saying the ALJ didn't pursue that line of evidence, further failure to follow SSR. And I'm not even going through the earlier paragraph about holding against Boyd the 1999 date when the record shows that he's seen later, which the commissioner presumably knew. You had the records.
Yes.
We're focusing on the commissioner's justification, not the ALJ's action. The commissioner's justification for taking the position that his treatment ended in 1999 when, in fact, it didn't.
That's correct. There was some indication in the record, although no doctor's records to support that, just Mr. Boyd's own statements that he did see two physicians sometime in 2000 and 2001.
Well, this says a report indicating he was seen three times in the later part of 2000 by Dr. Dana Elia and once by Dr. Suhail Hariri.
Right.
Same report three times over the course of 2001 by Dr. Elia.
Right. So two physicians.
And numerous visits. So that's not the same as nothing, right? So if the commissioner wants to get
right.
there and say nothing, and it's really six or seven visits, that's different.
Right. And on substantial justification, at the aegis stage, the district court really looks at this with a slightly different angle and says, well, wait a minute, though, but on balance, Mr. Boyd also has a responsibility in proving his ultimate claim of disability to bring forth some evidence to support his claim that he's been seen by these doctors. And he was represented by counsel, and the ALJ gave ample opportunity at the hearing to keep the record open so that he could have come back with those documents. And
so is it your position that if the record had shown, and I would just, let's say,
mm-hmm.
a hypothetical record
sure.
showed that there were five medical visits in the year 2001, and the commissioner notices that the applicant for benefits has failed to mention them in his brief, the commissioner is justified in writing a brief that says he was last seen in 1999?
I am not saying that the commissioner doesn't have a responsibility.
That would be a pretty extreme position to take.
Certainly there's a responsibility to develop the record. I'm not going to...
And not to misrepresent the record, too. I mean, to do your own study of the record and not make representations to the ALJ
right.
that are, in fact, inaccurate.
Right. I mean, he has a duty to look at all of the medical evidence and opinions.
And so does the commissioner in presenting arguments to the court. You can't just sort of say, well, we decided not to read the record, so we said, you know, treatment ended in 1999.
No, but I think that the district court really came down on the fact that this was mostly an articulation problem. There were some development issues that needed to be addressed that could certainly be done on remand, but... You know.
Well, why can't we read the district court's first opinion and decide? Of course, in part, 96.7P is all about articulation, so you would never have to follow the regulation if you think it's only about articulation, I guess.
Well, it talks about what you need to consider, and then it talks about presenting a clear explanation.
Right, so it's an articulation regulation.
Mm-hmm.
So haven't you made the whole thing meaningless? You've just said, oh, you actually never really have to follow it because it's only about articulation. And
no, I think that there are degrees of error that you have to consider in terms of articulation. It isn't simply you did articulate, you didn't articulate. Well, maybe it's about how much you've articulated. And here, the ALJ didn't completely fail to articulate a credibility finding. Certainly, the district court found that there were some problems, but...
But there are whole lines of evidence that he omits.
He does look at
at least
a lot of medical opinions.
At least and two lines of evidence that the district court says he omitted.
I don't know that they were considered lines of evidence.
Well, that's what the district court calls them. It's not my phrase. The district court calls them lines of evidence.
Well, but his clarification in the EJA decision is that it's really about how specific the explanations were. Certainly, there were activities considered. There were some medications considered. There were other treatment methods that were considered, such as physical therapy, and the ALJ looked at all these things. He looked at the objective medical evidence, and he also looked at evidence that, and this is in line with 96.7P, that very shortly after he suffered this very serious work injury, he was released to light duty, and he had what was actually termed as a miraculous recovery. So
right,
he's
but he seems to me one of these people who's trying awfully hard to do things, and he keeps thinking he can do things when he really can't. I mean, this was a terrible accident, of course.
Well, he's not going to be able to go back to heavy work, but we're talking about light work here. And I think that we can defer to the district court's own characterization of what it meant in finding error here. And like I said, with respect to 96.7P, there's a range of error. Certainly, if you have a Golombewski situation where you simply don't even talk about credibility, that's going to be the kind of egregious situation that Judge Posner was talking about. But then you might have a situation where a couple of things, you know, weren't mentioned. Obviously, that's a problem. You're going to have to go back. That's what remand is for. But are we willing to say that there was no substantial justification given the evidence that was before?
So what was the outcome of the remand?
I'm not certain of that.
You can get these fees even if you lose your case in the end?
Of course.
Yeah.
You mean EJA?
Yeah.
Yes, of course. I mean, it's...
I don't know why you say, of course.
Well, they're not, they're not always going
claim.
To be...
It's a little odd to give Ms. Fees.
Well, I mean, substantial evidence, as you said, is not substantial justification. They're not the same thing. And there are going to be degrees of error, and the government is substantially justified in defending certain positions, even if...
I don't think you understood my point.
No, what you're saying is sentence four remands get fees, even though after sentence four remand, the ultimate outcome might still be unfavorable to the applicant.
I'm sorry. Can you repeat that, please?
I understood your comment to reflect the fact that for a remand like this one, mm-hmm. a sentence four as opposed to a sentence six remand, you can get fees. EJA fees. That's what you just told Judge Posner, which was certainly my understanding of the entire body of law in this area.
That you're entitled to
right.
to fees
yeah.
unless
on that kind of remand, and they're not contingent on the ultimate outcome of the proceeding. After the remand. What's the point
of
the remand?
You have to be the prevailing party, obviously.
You prevail at the remand stage, but you don't. Do they take the fees away again if he loses after the remand? There are more proceedings that are going to happen in this case, right?
Yes.
Right. And the question had to do with what happens if he loses at that final phase.
I mean,
he still gets these fees.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. There are no other questions.
Thank you, Ms. Wenger. Ms. Goldblum?
Very quickly, Your Honor. What happens
is... Is the case over? Did he get his...
The decision, my understanding is that the decision hasn't come out yet. Apparently a hearing went well. That's all that we can say. But if on a remand the individual loses, then obviously the attorney can't get, the individual doesn't get their past benefits, and the attorney can't get paid for the administrative work. What the EJA does do, however, is that in cases particularly that go to the district court, an individual who gets past benefits, rather than having to pay the attorney a full 25%, which is generally going to be withheld, the EJA amount will be deducted from that, so the individual not only has the statute is served by encouraging attorneys, but also it eases the burden on the individual. But in terms of specific questions that were asked here, in this case, when you look at the merits decision from the district court judge, it wasn't just a lack of articulation, although I do think that there are times where just the lack of articulation can be the basis of an award. But as you noted, the district court judge himself noted two different lines that were not pursued, that were supposed to be pursued under the Social Security ruling 96-7P. And furthermore, in terms of this gentleman's ability, this credibility determination was really a linchpin because, as the district court judge noted, in terms of looking at the treating physician's report, that was discounted a great deal because of the credibility factor. The treating physician said this guy can only work for 4 hours. So credibility was a huge issue. This wasn't just a minor thing. And the district court did abuse its discretion. We ask that you reverse that finding and award EJA fees. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Sarko and Ms. Wang-Grim, and court will be in recess.